I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode. I'm Brandon Sedloff, Managing Director at Juniper Square, and you're listening to The Distribution by Juniper Square. On today's episode of The Distribution, I sit down with Wes Fuller, Global Chief Investment Officer of Greystar, the largest owner, manager, and developer of multifamily housing in North America. This episode was recorded in Greystar's global headquarters in beautiful Charleston, South Carolina. So I hope you'll check out the video on our YouTube channel. During our conversation, we discuss Wes's incredible journey working alongside Bob Faith to help build Greystar into the global juggernaut it is today, the trends impacting the living sector, and the maturation of for-rent housing across Europe, Australia, and parts of Asia. Let's get into it.
Wes, thanks for joining me today. It's great to be here in Charleston with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brandon, and welcome to Charleston.
Thank you. Yeah, it's... I say first impressions matter a lot, as I may have mentioned before when I walked up to your building. The gentleman downstairs greeted me with his first name and a handshake, pointed me in the right direction, and the hospitality here has been incredible. So
that's great
nice to
hear.
To do these in person.
Charleston is the friendliest city in America.
There you go. Well, I've been enjoying my time.
Awesome.
Well, I'm excited to chat with you. It's great to be in person. For our guests that are listening that maybe don't know you, could you take a moment and kind of introduce yourself, your role at Greystar, and then
sure.
We can kind of dive into your background?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm on my 20th year at Greystar, and I'm the company's CIO.
Okay.
I started at Greystar in 2003 after I graduated from business school at the University of North Carolina. Okay. And I have had an opportunity to live in Charleston with Greystar and Phoenix and Southern California. I lived in Solana Beach, not too far away from where you live in Encinitas. We had a chance to live in London for a few years as we were growing our Europe business. Have had a chance to spend some time in Asia and Sydney as we were growing our Asia business as well. So I've had a really interesting opportunity at Greystar to have some tremendous life experiences.
Yeah, it's been, with the size of the platform, and it's funny, this is our second time meeting in person. The first time I think was in London many years ago. So and maybe next time we'll have to do this in Asia on a different continent.
I'll take you up on that.
Yeah, me too. So you've been with Greystar for 20 years.
Yep.
Prior to Greystar, what were you doing before you decided to go back to business school? And then let's talk a little bit about the journey at Greystar, because I'm guessing 20 years ago you didn't join as the global CIO.
No. So when I graduated from college, I had a biology degree, and I had every intention of going to dental school.
Mm.
So I actually moved to Charleston to go to dental school. My dad's a dentist. My oldest brother was a dentist, or is a dentist. I was taking a year off in order to get in-state residency for the tuition to be, less expensive. During that year, I kind of decided that I didn't want to be a dentist, which is a big part of going to dental school.
What made you decide not to be a dentist? Something happened?
I didn't want to live in one place. Yeah. I think, it was the permanency of being a dentist is like you're effectively moving to a place and staying there. And I wanted to have a different lifestyle. So I had a biology degree. I needed to find a way to use it and ended up in the pharmaceutical industry, which was great. I could use the technical skills I had learned. And really learned a lot. The company that I worked for eventually became part of Pfizer, so it was a very large company. And I had the opportunity to, through a lot of persistence, to transfer from Charleston to Sydney, Australia, where I lived for 2 years prior to going back to business school.
Okay, so this is early 2000s.
So this is early 2000.
Yeah.
And so it was an important part of my life as I was looking for, I was gaining experiences trying to find my right career journey. But I knew it wanted to have an element of adventure, an element of excitement, certainly an element of international. Right. And so when I went to business school, I had never taken a business class. So it was only science class. And so business school was, I learned a lot. I had to learn a lot.
Yeah.
But you know, when I was in business school, the first week of classes was September 11th. And so I had the idea of working for a multinational company, being an expat, living around the world. And, you know, those opportunities obviously really shut down, you know, after September 11th. And a classmate of mine, a great friend, Leonard Wood Jr., suggested that I go to a real estate happy hour. He said, you ought to look at real estate as a career path and, you know, there'll be free beer. So I thought, well, that was a great idea. And I went to the happy hour and I met David Hartzell, who runs the real estate program at North Carolina, who's been a great mentor, a great friend, really since that night. And the speaker was an ex-student, Ross Cowan, who is also today, you know, a great friend. And Ross was at Transwestern, was at Northwood for a long time. And, you know, he just spoke about being able to, you know, travel around the country, and he was buying office buildings in different cities around the U.S. And I thought, well, if I can't do that internationally, perhaps real estate in the U.S. could be pretty exciting. And that was really my path, you know, into real estate at that moment. And I'm super thankful for Leonard and Dave Hartzell and Ross for that inspiration. And that's when I really got concentrated on real estate. And I was getting married at the time in Charleston. And so as you do to get out of wedding planning.
Looking for a job.
Of course, I'm looking for a job. And that's how I ran into Bob. And I met Bob during my first year of business school. You know, they weren't really doing MBA recruiting. They really didn't have they did not have an internship program. And so Bill Maddox, Bob's a long time partner of Graystar. He and Bob suggested, you should go work for Trammell Crow Company. Go do an internship with Trammell Crow Company, because that's where they had, their first stage of their careers. I said, great. And I didn't have any real estate experience. I'd have now only one semester of business classes. So I didn't have a strong foundation or a strong resume in order to get any type of internship or job in real estate. And I emailed, I think, every single Trammell Crow partner at the time and basically said, I'll come intern for you this summer for free, if you just give me a chance. Pat Henry, who's a partner at Trammell Crow Company at the time, gave me that chance. And so I had a wonderful summer with Pat and Joe McGorry in Atlanta, which was just a great way for me to get some level of experience and perspective in real estate.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you finished business school.
Yeah.
And then did you call Bob? And how did you move from being an intern at Trammell Crow to an employee at Graystar?
So very thankful for my experience at Trammell Crow Company, because that summer I realized one thing was that I was not interested where people worked.
Okay.
So I knew office buildings were not going to be my focus. It was not, there was no passion around an office park in Atlanta. And that's when I really got focused on multifamily and where people live. That was far more interesting to me. And that's when I really circled back and really focused on a job within multifamily. And I just, the relationship that I had started and was starting to grow with Bob and Bill and Derek Ramsey, who's our, CFO and been a long-term partner, just felt right. There was, it felt like the right cultural fit. It was a company with huge growth aspirations. It wasn't very large at that time, but it had—
How big was it?
You know, it was probably 25,000 units under management, probably under 1,000 employees. You know, I think Charleston had 8-9 people. So it was very small, relative to today's scale. And that growth aspiration, the aspirations that Bob had to grow, I felt like if I could get in, then I could quickly advance my career, which is what I wanted to do. Right. I was super competitive. And I had a lot of classmates who, like Leonard, were going to go work for Wood Partners. And I didn't want to be the ninth person to go work for Wood Partners when Leonard Wood Jr. was also joining the group. And right. I was like, well, maybe I'll go a different path, and I'll be the only MBA hire at Graystar. And that's how I landed in Charleston with Bob and Bill and Derek. And we've been, you know, partners ever since.
That's amazing. Yeah. I was listening to another podcast with Wes Whitman, yep. who I believe is associated with the firm. And
yep.
I understand you guys were maybe cohort mates, if I understand it correctly. And there was something about a team captain. What's that all about?
Yeah, well, you know, the early years of Graystar, so I would have joined in 03. Wes would have joined in 05, I believe.
Okay.
We recruited Wes from Harvard Business School. So once I was hired, I said, let's start an MBA recruiting program and let's go hire some a lot smarter people than me. So that's why we went to Harvard and started recruiting. A lot of those people work for us today, or we still do business with. And, you know, there was an investment business at Graystar that was run by others. And we were really looking to, you know, reboot the investment team and the investment strategy at Graystar. And, you know, Bob challenged me and four other really young, you know, young folks to go figure it out. And we put a business plan together with the help of Bob Whitman, who is, you know, Wes's father, and he's been a great partner for Bill and Bob and Graystar for a long time. We really created what was the beginning of, you know, our investment management business. It was really the rebooting of our investment management business. And I was fortunate enough to, I think, had just been around a little bit longer than everybody else, and I guess was anointed the team captain or the leader. So I was fortunate for that. Sometimes it's just helpful to be around.
Yes. I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that. So if you look back over the career at Graystar, what did the, you know, obviously we'll talk a little bit about the scope of the business here shortly, but what different roles did you hold over your evolution to get to where you are today as global CIO?
Sure. I think, you know, the first role was really an associate level role in Charleston, really learning the way that Bob thinks and the way that Bill thinks, the way that Derek thinks, and how they wanted to run the company, how they wanted to manage the company. Super helpful, super helpful. And then I was launched out to Phoenix to effectively run acquisitions for the Western region. And that was the opportunity to get experience, you know, acquiring deals in Phoenix and Vegas, Denver, Southern California, Northern California. And really from a moment that we didn't have a lot of equity to, you know, raising equity and structuring deals and closing deals. And, you know, really for the first 2 years, you know, it was just me. I didn't have an analyst pool. My wife broke down my rent rolls. You know, back then they didn't have rent rolls in Excel.
Right. It wasn't digital. Yeah.
Just paper.
Yeah.
So she was my first analyst, I guess. Yeah. And so when you're responsible for everything, finding the deals, capitalizing the deals, you know, obviously underwriting, the execution of the asset management, fixing problems, executing the renovations, you kind of learn the full scope of what it takes to execute a vertically integrated, you know, business model. And I think those learnings were super important to not just be the leader of something, but actually be the doer.
Right.
So really, you know, learned a lot during those years, you know, being out in California, I moved from Phoenix to California, being the investment person out there and really being reliant upon, you know, just me to execute. Then as the business started to grow, we obviously started to hire more people. We started to spread our wings a little bit across geographies. You know, learned a lot of lessons during that time period about the importance of having scale in the places where we invested.
Why is that important?
We learned very early on, and I remember helping the study that we did. It was like the internal analysis of our business in Houston, which, you know, had been where Bob had started the company, was our largest office. Had a great team there. Our properties performed great. Our investments performed great. It grew the fastest. It was the most profitable. So, you know, all these positives. And when we went down and looked at the reasons, of course, there wasn't one reason. It wasn't a person. It wasn't a reason. It was the strength of having scale, which allows you to attract great people. Great people execute, you know, at a very high level, which means your portfolio performs really well, which means your clients and your investors are happy, which means they give you more business. And it was that flywheel that spun faster in Houston as a result of that vertical integration business and our great people really executing really, really well at scale. And so that was the aha moment where, you know, Graystar said, if we want to be a great investor, a great developer, we're going to need to have scale in all the cities and where we have long-term conviction of strong fundamentals and, you know, where Graystar can build a business of scale. And I think if you think about that moment, that would have been in 2003 to today, that's really the theme of our scale. It's not the fact that we said, oh, let's go out and be this large company. It was, we need scale in specific places where we have high conviction over investing.
In the markets.
In those markets. Right. It's such a city focus. It just happens that there are lots of cities that need housing, that need rental housing. And so it's really the collection of those cities and, you know, adding that geography, which has created the size of Graystar. But it goes back to the basic premise of the benefits of having scale in a local city.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the importance of being in the office in the early days, and specifically the importance of understanding how Bob thinks.
Yep.
I think some of our listeners may know, you know, Bob had a career prior to Graystar, but what did you learn from your experiences with him directly in the early days, and kind of how has that stayed with you throughout your career as you've, you know, grown the business together with him as a partner and a leader?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are too many lessons to go through over, you know, my 20 years experience with Bob, because I learn one every day. It really is about, you know, managing your downside, because the upside always takes care of itself. I think that is something that he will say every week in investment committee. It's very true. It's very important. He's also somebody that is very entrepreneurial, and he highly values innovation, and he highly values, you know, growth initiatives, because growth initiatives allow us to continue to provide great opportunities for our people. And if you provide great opportunities for your people, then you attract great talent, and then that talent executes back to the flywheel that I mentioned earlier. And so, you know, Bob's been so instrumental on a lot of fronts, but those two areas I think are really important. You know, Bill's, you know, lasting legacy at Graystar will always be, you know, doing things the right way. And so, you know, Bob and Bill always instill, you know, we are going to be partner first. We're going to be team first. We're going to be people first. And the rest will take care of itself. And we're going to do things the right way. Those lessons, you know, are tools that all of us use every day, is when we go and need to make tough decisions, when we need to have tough conversations, when we need to go make a critical decision.
Yeah. It's important to have those guideposts on the journey, because as we know, the path is not always linear, right?
The path is not linear. And you know, the entrepreneurial culture, you know, has been there from the very beginning, is still here today, although there has been a lot of growth.
Right.
You know, to put it in context, how, you know, the housing industry is so large globally.
Right.
That we could be really busy growing at the same CAGR every year for the next 20 years, and our market share would still be de minimis.
Yeah.
So the opportunity is so big. So there are plenty of growth opportunities. It's really about being disciplined about focusing on the right opportunities. And I think that's the, you know, that's the key part about, you know, it's not just about being an entrepreneur, it's also being focused on growing the right way in the right places.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, how we got there, right?
Yep.
So you, the investment management business was what you were charged with back in the early days.
Yep.
How has that evolved? How did you decide kind of what your identity as an investment manager, as a fiduciary, was to be?
Yeah, I think when we came out of the global financial crisis, let's call that the big reset really for the whole industry and certainly for us. You know, in 2009, we really declared that we were going to be a fund management business.
And prior to that, what were you
We were doing strategic separate accounts, strategic relationships, you know, one-off joint ventures. We were going to continue those, but we also wanted to be in the funds business. And so we went out and raised a multi-investor, commingled discretionary fund that we started to raise in late 2009.
Great timing.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, well, it turned out to be great timing. It was really hard work to, you know, to raise the capital. I think we took 275 meetings over 2 years to get that.
Wow.
That was Graystar Equity Partner 7, you know, completed, you know, huge success, huge home run. But that was the reset of the business. And so if you kind of think about where we set a different path, it was, we were going to add the fund side of the business. And we were going to focus on institutional capital. We were going to focus on the source of capital, pension funds, endowments, you know, sovereign wealth funds. What we had the fortunate challenge, I'll say fortunate because at that time it was just a challenge, was that a lot of the U.S. plans at that time, you know, had denominator effects, or they had already picked a multifamily partner. And so to raise that capital, we had to look beyond just the U.S. And that's what took us to Canada. It's what took us to Asia, took us to the Middle East and into Europe. And so a lot of our investment relationships that we have with capital from, you know, ex-U.S. really began at that time. And so, you know, I think we, you know, we have over, you know, 200 investors from around the world. And you know, really every corner of the world is represented with an investor or multiple investors. And that really started at that point. I think a part of our growth really benefited from having to go outside of the U.S., you know, specifically after the global financial crisis.
So what was the story in 2009, 10, 11, 12, coming out of the global financial crisis that you were telling the international investors? And I don't mean story as a fictitious, like, what did they want to know? Why were they interested in housing apartments in the United States? Because one of the things I'm curious to get your take on is apartments were not traditionally one of the four major groups of institutional capital. And so, you know, we hear Greystar today, it's synonymous with apartments and living, and we take it for granted that institutional capital wants allocation because it's been a top performing sector. But if we look back, it wasn't that long ago where this was very alternative, very niche, and not many people were interested in it.
Well, I think if you go back to when Bob founded the company, so in 1993, he and Barry Sternlicht had co-founded Starwood Capital, and a lot of what they bought at Starwood were distressed, you know, was distressed notes. And a lot of those notes were backed by apartments. And what Bob realized at that point in time, what the economy was really down, but every apartment was filled and people were paying their rent. So even in times of economic distress, you still have stability at the asset level. But then he also couldn't find a lot of professional service providers. And it was really that moment where he said, I'm going to create the Trammell Crow Company of multifamily by, you know, by creating a blue chip, you know, service operation, because I know institutional capital is going to want to, you know, to invest in multifamily. That arc of how, you know, our asset class is institutionalizing is the, you know, very similar arc of Greystar. So we're going to continue to grow as long as that continues to happen. And it certainly is continuing to happen. But you're exactly right. The point in time was investors continuing to grow their real estate allocation to multifamily. If you look from 2010 to today, of course, it's been the largest growth of real estate allocations among real estate or amongst institutional investors. So that was a major tailwind. The second tailwind was more fundamental in that it was demographics. You know, you remember the generation was the largest generation in U.S. history, and they were entering their prime rental years. Home ownership was obviously out of favor because of the global financial crisis, coupled with supply pipelines being completely shut off. So a really strong fundamental backdrop. And then at that time, we had really completed the construction of a national platform. So we were, you know, had operators, investors, and developers in all the major cities around the U.S. And so what we could present to investors was not a regional allocation strategy, but it was the way to get exposure to the entire U.S. market through one firm.
Got it.
And that vertically integrated model, of course, we control our execution. So we can source, you know, we obviously operate, and, you know, this was a value add strategy. So we're actually buying and repositioning. We could all do that ourselves. And across the country.
And is that what the international institutional investors were most attracted to, the kind of single platform vertical integration?
Yeah, if you think about a Canadian investor making their first investment into U.S. multifamily in, you know, 2010, you know, how do they determine the best opportunity in the Southeast versus the Northwest versus Southern California? So it was really our platform and our ability to source deals across the country and then picking the best relative opportunities at the time, you know, that they saw a lot of value in.
So if we think back to Fund 7, 270 some odd meetings to get everybody, I think you said, when you heard no back then, why were people passing on the opportunity that you were presenting to them?
Well, there were a couple reasons. We don't have any capital today because we have other problems in our portfolio or denominator. So it was a capital availability. The second was, you know, some investors had not chosen to be sector specific allocators. And so they still wanted to provide capital to diversified funds. When an investor said, I have capital, and they said, and I want to make a commitment to multifamily,
right,
then our the probability of, you know, winning that commitment, you know, obviously went up dramatically.
Interesting. So let's take it to today.
Yep.
So maybe let's pause and kind of reflect. What does Graystar's business look like today?
Yep.
Maybe give us the
30,000
foot view.
I'll go back in history to 2012,
okay,
which was when we had that meeting where we had were successful in raising the capital. We really looked back and said, okay, what has been our experience and our feedback? And it was, wow, the fact that we built this national platform is really powerful. You know, we had a collection of international investors. We had some of those international investors tell us, hey, we really like what you do for us in the U.S. Have you ever considered, you know, building a business outside of the U.S.? And, you know, that tweaked our interest. And that's when we started looking at different multifamily opportunities or different rental housing opportunities around the world, and really settled on the UK, yeah, and specifically to purpose-built student. There was...
What year was this?
This was 2012 when Brett Lashley moved over and okay. I think was officing out of a Starbucks in London. And we did started doing our first transactions in 2013. The PBSA market in the UK, which is, you know, evolved tremendously since then, but at the time was in its infancy, but there had been a lot of entrepreneurial groups who had built portfolios. Global financial crisis, obviously the deleveraging of assets, you know, hit, you know, some particular owners hard. And so the distress wasn't necessarily at the asset level. The assets were still fully occupied and there were students who were filling up every academic year and paying rent. It was really the capital stack that was broken. And so we went in and Goldman Sachs was our original partner. We started to aggregate portfolios and started to build what now is our European business, right, which is our largest business outside of the U.S.
And for our listeners, PBSA is
Purpose-Built Student Accommodation.
Student Accommodation.
Yeah. Okay. Which, oddly enough, was the first institutional living sector asset class to mature in Europe before multifamily.
Interesting.
So
why do you think that is?
I think there were some really smart entrepreneurs who, you know, who started building businesses and portfolios just happened to be focused on students before multifamily.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So Graystar today, international. Let's talk about unit count, employees, you know, assets under management, anything kind of at that level to give us a framework.
Yeah. If you think about Graystar globally, we have an $80 billion AUM
okay.
business. This is a great, easy way to think about it. A third of that, both in unit count and what we own and, you know, and our equity under management and our total assets under management, about a third of that will be excluding the U.S., so international. And the way I think about it, I think that will be probably the ratio that we have forever because the U.S. market's so large and our business, of course, is mature.
Right.
So our U.S. business is going to continue to grow. Our international businesses will continue to grow. But a big part of our business is in Europe and in Asia, and then we have a business in South America as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So a third owned assets, owned assets in the U.S., a third international, and a third party managed. Is that the right?
So if you
think about it,
yeah. If you think about,
I'm not good at math.
So. No, I know. Let me break it down. Our global AUM, so the principal side of our business that we have an ownership interest in, is $80 billion.
Okay.
A third of that $80 billion. Is international.
Got it. Okay. Understood.
We manage 900,000 units.
Right.
About 240,000 of those are owned.
Okay.
So that breaks it down.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think the ratings just came out, and I know we talked earlier, you're not a big fan of ratings, but according to NMHC, which is the National Multifamily Housing Council, you're now the largest owner of multifamily, of apartments in the country. Is that the right way to think about it?
I believe that's the ranking. Yes.
Okay. And manager.
Okay.
Owner and manager.
Yeah. And developer as well.
And developer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Top three, trifecta.
Yep.
How many people are at the company across the different business units?
So it's 22,000 employees.
Okay. You said when you started it was about 1,000?
It's under 1,000.
Under 1,000.
Maybe our AUM was 300 million.
Interesting.
400 million, somewhere like that.
So when I think about Graystar, I think about multifamily.
Yep.
But when we've been talking, we're talking about living.
Yep.
Can you help me understand what that distinction is between multifamily and apartments
yeah.
and living? And then how does that apply to the global footprint? Does everybody think about it the same in Europe, Asia, South America, and the US, or is it all different?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll go back to like the milestone years.
Yeah.
You know, if 2009 was the milestone of, all right, we're going to go institutional capital and discretionary funds, 2012 is when we make the decision to go internationally. 2013 was the realization, because of our experience in the UK in the student housing space, was we needed to be more than a multifamily company. So we needed to be more than, you know, to go back, a Sunbelt multifamily company. Right. We're going to be a national company. You know, we're going to be more than just a joint venture, you know, investment business. We're going to be a discretionary fund business. We're going to be more than just a U.S. business. This was really the expansion of we should be more than just a multifamily company. And that's when that was really the formation of our, the living sector approach, which is really scaling up and building, you know, scale and expertise across the living sector. The sandbox would be described as student to multifamily to essential housing, call that the middle market, you know, housing, build for rent, purpose built, single family rentals, senior housing / active adult. Really looking at that sandbox as the living sector. And so when you think about that point in time of that's the future of Graystar, you know, that's really where we've been focused is really looking across that sandbox and saying, where are the best relative opportunities? But having scale and expertise in each of those is important.
And this may seem like a relatively ignorant question, but what are the parallels between apartments, senior, student? Yep. I mean, are they, you know, is it, there's a bed and that's the common denominator. And so effectively the economics are the same, or how differently do they function? Where are the synergies?
Yep. I think the way to think about it is you have a certain level of fixed cost necessary to be in this business, to be in the real estate business.
Yeah.
You have offices, you have people, you know, et cetera. So, so think about that as kind of, you know, a big part of the equation. And then the management of people, the management of properties, there's a lot of similarities.
Okay.
So let's just, for simplicity's sake, call it the 80-20 rule. So where 80% of it is similar, but 20% of it's very different. And the differences are specifically around your customer and the product.
Okay.
So as we all know, student housing is a different product.
Right.
It's a different customer. The way that you, you know, interact with that customer is different than the way you would interact with you know, your customer within senior housing.
Right.
So let's call that as part of the 20% rule. So your customer is different, the product is different, and the services at the asset level are very specific to that customer. That then you just apply that difference to, okay, well, what are the differences for traditional Class A multifamily? What are the differences for essential housing? What are the differences for single family rental? What are the differences for active adult as an example? And so you start to see like, well, we've got 80% of the commonality already embedded within Graystar. We just need to add the 20% that's specific. So that expertise, the way to design the product, the way to operate the product and, you know, and communicate with the customer. And that's when we really realized that 20% was something that, you know, was incredibly additive to what we did. And we could then get the benefits of scale across all of those products, you know, sub product types.
Interesting. And so if I look out a decade from now, Graystar is a living company.
Yeah.
Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah.
And am I right in assuming that one of the goals would be to attract the student when they go to school for student accommodation and keep them in your portfolio through the course of their life?
I think that's a good arc to follow maybe the next 10 years.
Okay.
Where, you know, we had, you know, those different milestones I mentioned earlier, you know, we don't really need to continue to grow from a geography standpoint.
Right.
We don't necessarily need to add new asset types.
Right.
We don't, you know, we have a, you know, great investor base. You know, we can continue to bring in new investors and grow market share with existing investors. So I think the next 10 years are going to be around a couple of different themes. I think it's going to be about scaling places that we're not at full scale.
Okay.
That's going to be certain asset types within the U.S. and it's certainly going to be markets like Canada, Europe, Asia, South America. There's a lot of growth opportunity. So it's going to be very focused on doing what we're already doing, but at larger scale. I think that the living sector is here and now. The conversations that we're having with investors about living sector allocations versus 10 years ago when it was about multifamily allocation, you know, is far more common. But I think what really drives the living sectors is urbanization. And so the overarching theme, of course, is urbanization. It's people living in cities. And when they live in cities, you know, they live in high density housing. And if housing's unaffordable or very expensive, or unaffordable, then people live in rental housing. And so the, you know, urbanization drives demand for housing, which continues to drive, you know, strong fundamentals for us, but also, you know, you end up with a huge last mile logistics opportunity as an example. And so, you know, we're in the logistics business as well. You're going to see us continue to invest in our platform where urbanization, people living in cities, is driving demand for real estate. I'd say like in the next 10 years, that will be a conversation, hopefully, that's worth talking about.
Interesting. I didn't know that you were in logistics. Maybe tell me a little bit about that platform since, you know, I wasn't aware of that.
Sure. In 2020, we acquired Thackeray Partners and we merged Thackeray Partners into Graystar. The two principals of Thackeray were Tony Donna and Mary Hager, who have been long-term, you know, friends of Graystar. Tony had been on our board for a long time. One of their expertise was in industrial. So we brought their team over and merged them with Graystar to add the intellectual property around logistics. And then we've been plugging that intelligence into our development platform and building a portfolio of logistics. I think we have about 8 million square feet that is either completed or under development today. Wow. And so that's a huge growth opportunity for us, not only in the US, but also in the other markets around the world where we already have a development presence and where there's a interesting logistics opportunity.
Maybe I'm going too far, but two questions come to mind. One is last mile logistics. Does that support the density around the assets and what your tenants want and require and the ability to get that to them quickly as kind of a differentiator?
Yeah, the parallel between density of rooftops means people, which right. means ordering goods, which online. Means demand
yeah. okay.
for last mile logistics. Yeah, they are certainly interconnected.
And is there another play potentially where some of these last mile logistics sites meet the path of urbanization and potentially a redevelopment opportunity?
You know, it's interesting. You and I didn't talk about this before.
No, we didn't.
But that has been an output that surprised us. We do have development sites which are half multifamily and half logistics.
Interesting.
It's been really interesting. So yes, those worlds are merging more and more because of, again, urbanization bringing rooftops to cities.
So let's talk about that
sure.
kind of macro then, since we covered Graystar and a little bit about your background here at the company. What are, like, when you zoom out, you have a global perspective focused yeah. on living,
yep.
very broad. What are kind of some of the big trends besides urbanization that you're observing that are kind of driving, you know, and demographics, obviously,
sure.
what else is driving the growth of the sector?
So, you know, the way that we kind of view the world is, you know, we've got a global platform. We have, you know, people in 17 different countries and 36 different offices where, you know, we really look at data. We use market intelligence. Obviously, we use our teams to effectively force rank where we see the best opportunities around the world. And we call it our high conviction investment strategy. So
yeah.
it's, we talk about it every day. And that is being a very strategy led, you know, business where we want to go and we want to invest with our partners where we believe that there are the best opportunities. So I'd say that that's an everyday thing at Graystar is yeah. we are constantly digesting our data. And with 900,000 units,
it's a lot of data.
It's a lot of information.
Yeah.
With 22,000 employees, there's a lot of intellectual property. There's a lot of on the ground intelligence. We pull all that together to have our house view, to create the house view. And a way to think about a house view is, okay, we have high conviction over a specific strategy for very specific reasons. We will find like-minded partners who agree with us or will invest, you know, with our discretionary funds. And then we'll execute with our platform. You know, that's a really key component. And that execution at the platform level comes really through, you know, a really methodical approach, which is, you know, the high conviction investment strategy wrapped with capital. You know, that's a hunting license for our teams to go source the right opportunities.
Right.
So that strategic and directed sourcing, I think, is one of the things that Graystar should be defined as. You know, we are really good at, our teams are incredible at finding the right deals, given the right hunting licenses.
Okay.
So that pipeline is really important part of what we do as a company, is really sourcing the right deals. The execution, of course, you know, is part of our investment teams and our development teams and our operating teams. And so that's how we operate, you know, and certainly the team with me at, you know, in the office of the CIO, it helps drive that throughout the company. So, and so that's a lot of what we do. Now, the major themes that are defining the high conviction strategies, is, it's not complicated, Brandon, thankfully, It's you know, you look first at fundamentals.
Right.
You know, where do you have excess demand, you know, then supply? That's the first screen. Okay. The second screen is where do we have a competitive advantage, where we can drive, you know, returns on top.
Yep.
Where are opportunities mispriced, where your entry purchase is attractive relative to other entry purchases. Where's the flow of capital going or flowing away from? Okay. And so you kind of put all those factors in, and those are, you know, a lot of the ingredients that would go to produce what's high conviction or, frankly, what's low conviction or things that we don't want to spend time on. I think when you look at, when you look at the U.S. today as an example, of course, supply is like the story. And it's true. There is, historical levels of new completions, last year, this year.
Historically low levels.
High levels.
High levels right now.
Yes. High levels of completions. And so what you're seeing is those areas where supply is outstripping demand, you have weakness in rent, in rents. It's, and the data, of course, is pretty clear. In areas where you don't have necessarily the same completions, you have demand that's in excess of supply. So you have rent growth.
Right.
And so you're now seeing a differentiation of market performance. And with that comes a differential in pricing. So if you go back to September of 2021, every market was priced at a 3 cap.
Right.
It didn't matter whether it was Richmond or Southern California. It was crazy. And so, that was an anomaly. Today is really more of a normalized market where you have differentiation of performance really based on both pricing and fundamentals. So how do you pick the right markets, the right product is very important. It's a stock picker's market
right
today. Very important. I think when you look at student, and I'll touch on some of the other regions, but if you look at student in the U.S., hasn't had the oversupply that multifamily has. In fact, supply is about half of what it typically is in student. You have very specific universities with growing enrollment.
Right.
So look for the combination. It's not difficult of growing enrollment with lower supply. That's where you're going to see outsized, student demand. And that's translating into outsized rent growth. So we're seeing rent growth in student that's double to triple what you're seeing in multifamily. So, so we have a lot of conviction over student as an asset type at specific universities.
Okay.
Picking the universities.
Stock picker's market again.
Yeah, it's a stock picker's market again. Build for rent in the U.S., long-term secular trend of demand. It will take time for that segment of our business to grow and to scale. There's a lot of really smart companies that are building businesses that have done really well, will continue to do well. But if you just look at basic demographics, in the U.S., when somebody is under 35, their propensity to rent is around 70%, and then it flips when they're over 35.
Right.
And the reasons, of course, are obvious. You get married. You want to have more space. You want to have kids. Your kids are going to go to school. And so you're seeing that population, that demographic wave that kind of set multifamily on fire and, coming out of the global financial crisis is now starting to enter their mid-30s, which is going to start kickstarting demand for single family formats. And with home ownership where it is today, rental is just going to be a big part of that decision.
Right.
And of course, we're seeing in our move-out data, with 900,000 units, 40% turnover rate, you have a tremendous amount of people who move out of apartments every single year. We know exactly where they move. So you see the number one reason for move out is to move into a single family home. And that percentage of people moving out to single family home, but as a renter, is increasing dramatically. So I think that's another, compelling high conviction strategy. If you go to Europe, as another example, Europe and the U.S. have a very different supply situation. Europe doesn't have a mature multifamily industry. So if you think about the supply that's added in the US, 350 to 500,000 units annually, doesn't exist in Europe because there's not a Greystar or the Wood Partners and the TCRs of the world building apartments every single year at scale. So every single major city, specifically around Western Europe where we're focused, chronically undersupplies their city with housing of all types, for sale and rental. So you have a chronic supply of housing in a normal market. Today, we're not in a normal market because supply deliveries are declining dramatically across all of the cities in Europe. But you still have urbanization, you still have population growth, you still have employment growth in these cities. And so you have demand that's far outstripping limited supply. And that's why the Europe backdrop is incredibly interesting to be both a developer and an investor in rental housing, is that you have all those elements I mentioned earlier. You have really, really strong fundamentals. You have Greystar has competitive advantages because we built a big platform around around Europe. We have 1,000 employees. We have 65,000 units that we own in Europe. You know, we've transacted on $15 billion of investments since we started Europe in 2013. So we have a lot of competitive advantages because of our scale. And then there's a lot of liquidity coming to the market because a lot of investors see the divergence of the U.S. market with the European market. People want more exposure to the living sector. They want exposure to Europe because it's a hole in their portfolio allocation.
Right.
So all of those things that we look for our high conviction strategies are really kind of coming into focus for Europe. And so our prediction would be that Europe, whether it's student or multifamily, is going to have a really interesting run over the next 5 years. So those would be a couple of examples of just how we use data and our platform and our market intelligence to kind of have house views on, you know, where to spend our time and capital.
Asia? Is Asia on your radar? I know you have a platform in Australia, right?
Yeah, we have our Asia business. We have offices in Tokyo, Shanghai, Singapore, Sydney, and Melbourne.
Okay.
And we have teams in all of those places.
Very different demographic drivers across those countries in the region.
Yes, it's the U.S. is pretty easy.
Yeah,
one rule of law.
Yeah,
Europe is you know, from a geography standpoint, very close.
Right.
But obviously has different rule of law, different cultures. Very manageable. Asia is a different challenge in that you have both different, very different cultures, very different markets, and you have the what I love the Australians call the tyranny of distance. You know, all those countries are far away from each other and far away from here. But the Japan market is very mature. They have a very mature multifamily market. And so that is a market where capital is very attracted to. You can acquire existing assets, predictable cash flow, mature financial markets and capital markets. Australia, similar to Europe, where their student housing industry matured faster than multifamily. So there's a more mature student business. There's a growing multifamily business.
Okay.
And it's based on the same fundamentals that they simply don't build enough housing. And housing is unaffordable to the average Australian. And then you know, China, we can probably spend an hour talking about China, but a very different situation in China. Yeah.
When you think about urbanization, and I think you and I first met when I worked for the Urban Land Institute, so this is a kind of a topic of a lot of intellectual curiosity. What, you know, kind of what were the most noticeable trends that you saw during the most recent period during COVID in terms of deurbanization, reurbanization? Like, what did you observe in your portfolio? And then what are you anticipating? I mean, are you anticipating the continued urbanization of U.S. cities in particular? I think, you know, Europe and Asia are probably each different conversations, but let's focus on the U.S. for the time being.
Sure. It's a great question. And what we saw was really interesting. And we were all we're still all fascinated about where people are moving and why they're moving.
Yeah.
And if our head of research, Michael Joyce, was here, you know, he'd be jumping in his chair to tell you all of the unbelievable stats that we've learned about why people are moving and where they're moving.
Right.
But we certainly saw in cities that had strict lockdowns, people left. Everybody saw it.
Right.
I'm not telling you a story. A lot of people either moved to the suburbs, as we know, moved to the countryside. London was no different, you know, in the U.S. Other people relocated to different cities, but they went from urban environment to urban environment.
Yeah.
And then what has happened since the longer term impact is that people have moved back to cities. What's interesting is our average age of our resident in New York, as an example, decreased 3 years. Okay. So it got younger.
Interesting.
So our tenant base at our portfolio in New York, 3 years younger.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because the older people, it was the impetus to go buy the house in the suburbs.
Yeah.
You know, it was
move to Florida.
Yeah. Or move to Florida, you know, go make that life decision, right, which then freed up an apartment for a younger person to move to the city.
Interesting.
And I think young people who are apartment renters.
Yeah.
Want to be in cities. They want to be where the action is. They want to be where their other friends are. They want to be where their young people are. They want to be close to their job, close to their entertainment, you know, nodes. And I don't think that's going to change. Certainly, we don't see that in the data changing. But what it has created are maybe different urban nodes. So if you think about the Sun Belt, you know, there's been a lot of Sun Belt relocation, but it, you know, a lot of that relocation is still someone seeking an urban environment. And the term urban, at the ULI, I think there was always a long debate on like the definition of urban. I'm really talking about city living,
right?
You know, where somebody's moving to an MSA to be attracted to that MSA,
right?
And we don't predict that to change.
Yeah. Well, we need our farmland, so that's good. You mentioned earlier in your career during your internship with Trammell Crow Company, you realized you weren't as passionate about offices, but you're starting to speak the language of a lot of people listening to this podcast, which is okay. You know, let's see if we can have a return to office.
Yep.
In order to do that, we need people to move back to MSAs,
yep,
back to cities. But I'm curious, you probably have data or insights into kind of usage patterns inside of your buildings, either from an amenitization perspective or, you know, do you have any insights on for those younger people moving, yep, into cities, are they working from Graystar apartments or Graystar, you know, purpose-built rental, single, yep, family housing, or are they, you know, leaving to go elsewhere to a workplace and that's what's attracting them back to the cities?
Well, it's a great question. It's a great point, which is, you know, kind of creating two different answers in a way of how should our buildings be designed and, right, operated differently as a result of more people who work from home?
Correct.
That's a long-term trend. We don't believe that's going to change. It changes our unit mix. It changes our unit layouts. It certainly changes our amenities and our services.
Okay.
So, you know, that's something that we put a lot of thought into where, perhaps us in the industry 15 years ago would have said an amenity is a selling point for a new resident. That's no longer. Amenity is something that will be used, and we need to ensure that it's programmed appropriately for that use. And so I think it's being far more thoughtful on not just the purpose of the amenities, the amount of the amenities, and then the services provided within those amenities, because the fact that people are going to be home more often is here to stay.
Okay.
So now that also changes, you know, your unit mix in a way, in that you probably are going to have more two-bedroom units because you're going to have people who want to work from home and have an office. And so thinking about the evolution of the unit mix is obviously another change. I'll switch to like how we think about our teammates,
yeah,
and, you know, work from home versus, versus being in the office. We're flexible with our direction. And so we don't have a set policy. Being an entrepreneurial company,
yeah,
you know, you could imagine that we probably don't have like a set in stone policy. I think what we have found is like you've come into this office in Charleston. This office was completed in 2018. It was always intended to be an open office. It was never intended for anybody to have an office. Bob doesn't have an office. I don't have an office. It's a hotel desk concept,
yeah,
where people show up and just pick a place to sit. When Bob really drove that philosophy in 2016, 17 with the construction of this office was like perfect from a flexible working, yeah, environment, because people love coming to work here because there's tons of meeting space. You get to meet a lot of different people. You get to interact with different people. And it's created this environment that naturally attracts people back to the office, not under a rule,
right,
but naturally
they
because
wanna
people want to, yeah, be here. And there's a lot of value in our teams working together in person. And, you know, we certainly encourage that, but we remain flexible, you know, when people come into the office or not. We've taken this model of design and replicated to all of our offices around the world. So I think we have several more offices to complete, but, you know, London, as an example, we're opening up a new office in London in a couple of weeks. It'll have this look and feel.
Okay.
And so this is the real model to create a quality workplace that people want to come to,
right,
and they want to be with their teammates in a safe and you know, inviting environment. So I think we want people to want to come to work,
right,
not force them to come to the office. So that's been, you know, really, you know, Bob's approach, our approach. But what we have found is cities like, you know, maybe San Francisco, London, Sydney, New York, certainly, where your teammates tend to have smaller apartments in those cities because those cities are expensive. There's not space to work from home.
Right.
So they want to come to the office. So, you know, we were running, you know, well over capacity in London as an example that, and we had to go get more office space. So we were actually growing our office space because, you know, the number of people coming to the office was increasing. The percentage of people were increasing and our team was growing. And so that's where maybe a city like Charleston would differ to a city like New York or London.
Right. It's interesting though, because at the end of the day, your charge is to build residences and homes, places where people could work from home if they chose to, but also create a, you know, culture and allow for the flexibility for your teammates and your residents, right, that live in these apartments and work elsewhere.
Yeah, we are in the business of creating communities, which are physical spaces and services, so that people want to live with us and stay with us,
right,
and value it.
Right.
That's our value proposition to the resident, that customer. We can't do that unless we have high-performing teams. So we have to have a similar approach to creating the right environments and the service and right, the culture of our teams. And that comes with physical space in addition to, you know, the soft culture. And so, you know, we're hyper-focused on that. And of course, we don't get to have high-performing teams or, you know, the properties and the residents without our investors. So you got to think about the DNA of Graystar. It's really thinking about, you know, how do we please our residents? How do we build the right teams, you know, attract and retain high performing teams? Then how do we execute for our partners? You know, our business model is really simple. We have to do those three things really, really well. And then everything else to kind of takes care of itself. And that's why the rankings don't matter, because if we could have a ranking, but if we don't have high performing teams who love working here and want to spend their careers here and our partners aren't happy and our residents aren't happy, it much doesn't matter. But those three things really, really matter.
I love that. I think that's a great place to wrap up the conversation. We could go on forever. There's a lot to unpack about Graystar, but it's great to see you again after so many years. And thanks again for hosting me in your office here in Charleston. And I enjoyed the conversation very much.
I did too. I appreciate it, Brandon. Thanks.
Thank you, Wes.
Thanks.
Great seeing you.
You too.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.